Love, therefore, became a shadow symbol, a word symbol for the supreme passion of the human soul, the passion of St. Francis of Assisi, the passion of St. Buenaventura and Santa Teresa, the passion of those in whose spiritual experience there is this tremendous unfolding of absolute adoration for the infinite beauty in the root of existence. I think the Muslim, in many ways, worshipped beauty, or worshipped a God who walked in beauty. To him, the beauty of existence was of the greatest psychic appeal. Again, perhaps, because it represented a kind of world that he knew only in a fragmentary way. One little rose growing in the desert by the side of some oasis. He saw this beauty flash but seldom to his eyes, and therefore it had great and sublime meaning for him. It became perhaps the eternal symbol of that which is most desired. Out of this came the strange lovesick language of the Persian poets, in which it seemed as though they spent all their days and nights serenading some blessed damosel. But actually this whole strange pageantry, this wonderful symbolism, had to do only with the experience of this eternal recognition of the overwhelming beauty of the universe itself, the unattainable perfection of infinites, before which every human being knelt in utter surrender. The pure experience of love itself, apart from any addiction to human frailty, the power to reach out and simply to love life, to reach into the unknown and find there the infinite loveliness of God. This moved these people, moved them to produce some of the most glorious literature the world has ever known, a literature, however, which we have utterly failed to understand, a literature which perhaps most of them never really understood, but which shines with the strange light of this ecstasy of man's ever-seeking for reality. And under the mysterious symbol of inspiration, this infinite longing for the light, the mystic of Islam used the symbol of the vine. To him, wine was the symbol of ecstasy, even as it was in the Bacchic rites of ancient Greece, and continued to carry the same essential meaning in the Eucharistic mysteries of Christianity. The mysterious power of wine, the wine of life, seemed to lead to a parallel that was very interesting. Man taking a little more wine than was his need, suddenly released from himself his true and essential nature. Wine was the remover of inhibitions. Wine made the tired old man young and glad again. Wine made the vicious man more vicious and hateful. Wine made the stupid, lazy man more lazy and more stupid. Wine always brought from the individual something of himself. And this wine, in turn, was a symbol of the forgetfulness of mortal things. It caused the individual to enter into a strange fool's paradise, in which whatever he really wanted or ever he really thought could be true, at least for a little while, until, as Omar points out, finally this kindly, friendly vine turns like a monster and strangles those that use it. But it was like, in a way, the wine of ecstasy itself. And so we hear much of the Sufi and his wine jug. We hear that for wine he sacrifices all other things. that he turns from the glories of the world to the simple joys of the bottle. What he is telling us really is something entirely different, that he had discovered in the universe a mysterious agent, an agent of luminous energy. He had discovered the intoxication of self-forgetfulness. He had discovered that without touching any of the fruit of the vine, that he could be drunk with God. Now this was perhaps a rather crude way of saying a great thing. But we might remember that to the Muslim, wine as we know it was actually forbidden. Therefore, that what we read in these poetic works should not be interpreted as literal. But this intoxication with life. Imagine the man in the desert seated beside his camel looking out into the night. Looking out as men have looked from a thousand different mountainsides and valleys and forests and deserts and hills into the dawn of things. And suddenly, as in the case of Lao Tzu on the side of the mountain in China, suddenly the whole universe opened up. Suddenly the mountains and the valleys and the skies seemed to split asunder, and everywhere was radiance. Everywhere was a tremendous light of insight. Suddenly the divine power itself seemed to descend and enfold mortality. Everywhere the eye of the mystic looked, there was only God. There was only light and truth. If he turned his ears inwardly to listen, he heard only the strange mystic chanting of the spheres. Every sound was beautiful. Every odor was that of flowers and incense. If he reached out his fingers, he touched something softer and more wonderful than the most precious silks. Everything that touched his senses was transformed into an absolutely perfect thing. Something so wonderful that in the presence of it he melted. He wept. Strong men wept simply because of the beauty of God. If this experience happened in these far distant places of the desert, then these men were said to be intoxicated. They were the God intoxicated ones. Some said they were mad, but madness of this kind was in the keeping of Allah, and no man would dare to molest or injure a madman. They were the beloved of God, for in their madness they had remained with Him, and their minds had never come to earth. This strange madness of the desert mystic, which suddenly swept him into this ecstatic universe of light and beauty. This was the wine of ecstasy. It was light, it was life, it was the love of God flowing in space. A man became drunk with it. And in his intoxication, he had what perhaps the Westerner would call a mystical experience, for he was possessed by God. Yet when he was so possessed, he didn't see God. He did not actually hear the voice of God. No great miracles were performed before his wandering vision. The thing that heralded, marked the presence of God, the thing which made him know that God was there, was sheer beauty. Beauty that transcended every sensory faculty that he possessed. He was in the presence of absolute beauty. And this beauty was alive with infinite love. He was therefore standing in the sublimation of every instinct, every appetite, every perception and reflective power that he possessed. He was alone in space with this experience of being enfolded by the wonder of God. This was his intoxication. This was the wine of the poet. Well, the wine was simply the mystical experience. Here in the West, we have some records or some accounts of this experience. Among the saints of Christendom, there is a beautiful description of an experience of this kind by Havelock Ellis in his Dance of Life, an experience that occurred to him. But to the men of the desert, it would be different, because they came from a different world and they had a different need within the empty psychic need within themselves. It was different. They could not have the experiences of a European saint or an Asiatic yogi. Their experience had to be of the desert, of their land, of their way of life. So they had this strange sense, as one poet said, that suddenly, truly, the desert blossomed as a rose. Suddenly the desert was beautiful. Truly it was the garden of Allah. And all of a sudden, all of its sorrows, its tragedies, and its bleached bones disappeared from their awareness. The desert itself was one great beauty. In old times also, there was another group of men who had the same kind of experiences. And these were the men who went down to the sea in ships. For in those days, ships were small and men were strong, and the storms were great upon the deep. But every man who loved the sea regarded it as a strange and lovely thing. To the sailor of old, the sea was more wonderful than any woman could possibly be. Its moods were as terrible as any strange passion that could move the earth. And yet these men who fought the sea loved it, and their one hope above all else was that when the end came, they would die at sea, and their bodies would rest forever in the deep. And as these men had their mystical experience at night, watching the endless waves of the ocean, and found their great love in the ocean itself, so the men of the desert, watching the sand and the light shining on it, found their great love in the desert. And the desert became the universe, and the desert became the abode of God. And the desert, with all its moods, were the moods of God. And how else can we describe the strange experiences that these people had? Well, we also know that in the course of these strange ecstasies, that the mystics of Islam gradually did reverse the polarity of their consciousness, so that they were not quite sure which world was real. And as their mysticism became more intense, as their asceticism advanced, as it also did in other Asiatic nations, there was really an exchange of worlds, even while men lived. Here in the West, the world beyond is something we wait for with fear or hope after the termination of our mortal life. But to these meditating sages and seers, the other world was already an achieved reality. They had already wandered back and forth between the regions, even while they were still in mortal flesh. And not only were these symbols very real and important to them, but they discovered a microcosm within themselves. If it was true that the universe was the body of a great deity, as was taught by the Greeks and more or less accepted by the early Islamic scientists, so surely man fashioned in the image of this creator was also a universe. And man had within himself all of these strange mysteries that were seen at night in the desert, for man's body was a desert. And yet this body in which he dwelt, outwardly apparently desert-like, subject to all the strange storms and terrors of darkness and of fear, within man was also another region, a region that could be found only by the individual who was able to disentangle his consciousness from the binding pressures of objectivity. Here was your yoga again. Here was the individual determining that he had two lives, just as nature in the desert had two lives. There was the outer life of man, man dwelling in a house with walls of mud and a roof of reeds or wood. Man struggling every day to guard his herds against the ravages of his neighbors or of beasts. Man growing faint and tired and finding only a small consolation in the companionship of other mortals like himself. Man in the desert, seeing very few other human faces, alone in a strange, almost uninhabited world. And then yet this man, suddenly realizing, as the dervish or the Sufi in his musings, that he had his own inner life. He looked at his hands and they were toil worn. His face was wrinkled by the wind and sun, his body bent with years. But there was within him something ever young and ever new. Also within himself, he could have any kind of life he really wanted. Inside of him, there was a life beyond poverty, beyond sickness, beyond age, and beyond death. So the mystic decided that within his own soul, he could build the secret garden of his heart's desire. And the mystics always symbolized the quiet inner life as a beautiful garden, like the garden of the troubadour, within which grew forever the rose of immortality. So by entering into your own life, if you so desire and are so willing, you can enter always and walk with beauty. You can find the secret garden of your own subjective existence. Here you will find all the flowers never fade. You will find that no weeds come into this garden unless you permit them to. You can enter into this garden as the seven sages of China retired to their bamboo grove. And here you can do all the beautiful things and think all the beautiful thoughts and feel all the beautiful emotions that seem vain and foolish and audacious in the material world. Here you can sing songs of great beauty even though your physical voice cannot carry a tune. Here everything can be as you want it to be. Now in the West we are very afraid of these things. We are afraid that the individual will sink into a kind of imaginary world and there he will become a hopeless psychotic and never come out again. We believe that men can drown in their own subconscious or their own psychic dilemmas. Perhaps this is true if this inner world has been strangely and terribly contaminated. But the men of the desert were a simple people. They had very few great ambitions. Wealth was beyond even a hope. Success was only for those who were born to command. For the rest, life was the desert, the sheep, the little village, the mosque. There was nothing else. So these people, while perhaps they were rather savage or barbaric within in their outer lives, were strangely childlike within themselves. They could go into themselves without finding complication, which we cannot do. They had been brought up always in a faith which they had held very close and sacred. They had kept the simple commands of the Quran as best they could. They had faith in Allah and His Prophet, upon whose name be peace. Therefore, these people were strangely simple in themselves. And when they went into themselves, they did not find deceit. They found rather a quiet place, untouched by great anxieties or great selfishness. And in this quiet place, as in a small allotment of land, they could build a garden as they wished it to be. So they had the walled garden. It was walled because it was surrounded on every side by body. It was a secret garden because no one but themselves could ever enter it. Even if others were invited, they could not come in. Only their ghosts could enter, their ghosts being their thought likenesses created by the master of the garden. In this secret garden, man was the master of the show. And around him the shadow forms that came and went. And here in this magic garden, the individual built his own paradise, the paradise of dreams, of great and noble hopes and aspirations. The mystic, the Sufi particularly, had the suspicion down inside of himself that perhaps this magic garden was the antechamber to paradise. Perhaps man building this secret garden of good in himself was building the region in which he must sometime live. Perhaps all of this mystery was psychological. That the inner life of man was really his world. And when he cast off this mortal flesh, his soul would go to the magic garden he had built, and there abide in the beauty he had fashioned until the will of Allah called it forth to other labors. In whatever case it might be, to the believer, this magic garden became very real. There is no doubt in the world that these people could invoke this mood at will. There is also no possible doubt that it was possible for them to revive it in a continuous pattern, as the points themselves so noted, so that every night when a man went to sleep, he could will himself to go back into his garden and continue his labors there. That he had an inner life of continuous internal reminiscence. Perhaps it started as daydreaming. Perhaps it started by the individual consciously fashioning this place, by meditation, or as the Easterners say, by will and yoga. But after a time, this inner meditation became real. It became something that happened of itself. And little by little, this inner garden was built to greater and greater perfection. This probably is underneath the Chinese concept, which we find in the doctrines of the released or spiritually regenerated being, the transcendent being of the Chinese classics, a being fashioned by man out of the virtues of himself, this being finally becoming the body for his own consciousness. In any event, this region of the psychic creativity of the mystic is recorded in many places and probably lies close to the source of the descriptions of visions that we find all the way from ancient Egypt to Emanuel Swedenborg. These visions seem real. Andrew Jackson Davis, the seer of Poughkeepsie, the American mystic and psychic, describes the summer land, which he actually visited in his own psychic experiences. Here was a beautiful land of mountains and valleys and shrines and temples where everything was beautiful and everyone was good. He really believed that he saw these places. And many spiritualistic paintings depict, in a rather vague way, the semi-paradisical abode of the blessed. Many works on psychic phenomena also consist of messages supposedly coming from persons dwelling in these strange radiant vistas. The Sufi almost surely tells us the clue, or gives us the clue to the whole thing, the magic garden of his own believing. The mysterious visualization within himself which finally caused this vision to take substance. Here, I think, we come also very close to a problem involving modern psychology in the West. Man's subconscious here in the West is so heavily loaded with the formal worldly pressures that we push into it. We have made this material world so real that it obsesses our sleep. We have made it so complete in its domination over our lives that it dominates the inner as well as the outer part of man. This is its danger. This is the reason why we can have a psychotic. This is the reason why the individual can become mentally and emotionally sick inside. This sickness is due to the tremendous power which he possesses to internalize external things, and at the same time to carry into this internalization all the unfulfilled ambitions and pressures and longings of his life. All of these, however, worldly. All of these binding the internal to the external. All of these making it seem to be necessary for man to succeed as a physical being in order to attain any degree of consolation of spirit. Spirit depends upon matter for its fulfillment in Western man. Spirit depends upon wealth, achievement, prestige, and status for its satisfaction. While this continues, of course, the individual will have not a quiet inner life, but a heavily conditioned one. The inner life of the average person is simply not suited for any form of tranquility. We go inside and we find chaos and confusion. We find no beautiful garden, but rather a terrible and horrible land of witchcraft and sorcery. In some way, the medieval experience of witchcraft, which brought so many generations of misery into European history with the persecution of poor, deluded souls. This whole situation seems to have resulted from the fact that the Black Mass was celebrated in the heart of man himself, and that the bracken from which the witches flew on their broomsticks was part also of a legendary atmosphere that arose in the subconscious of mortal man. So there was some reason why, when the Western man relaxed, he found himself in purgatory, and the Eastern man, in his relaxation, finding himself in paradise. Neither one really tried to build, by the common processes that we know, a conditioned existence. The Eastern man did not realize that he was trying to create a virtuous life, and certainly the Western man was not aware that he was attempting to integrate his own vices into an overwhelming obsession. These were not the thoughts, they were conditions of existence. The man of the desert did not have the pressures, therefore he did not create the psychotic tensions. He had a different attitude toward life. He believed in God. He really, sincerely, and devoutly believed. And being of simple nature, even his violences were simple. And by degrees he realized that his greatest achievement was to transmute violence that his earthly passions could become almost divine compassions. So he sort of changed the level of his reactions, seeking to use his sentiments, his most amorous inclinations, to court eternal beauties. Western man went the opposite way. He commercialized his arts. He prosecuted and persecuted his mystics. He did most of the things that would naturally be against the mystic life. And today he finds himself without this mystic life. And wherever his ways are spread upon the world, other nations lose their mystic overtones also and begin to develop the same ailments and pressures that afflict Western humanity. The Sufi lived in the borderland between great empires. He realized that there was a vast European structure rising from the decline and fall of Rome, that the great Byzantine Empire was close upon him, that there was a rise of the Huns and the Goths and the Visigoths. He also knew something of the distant shadowy wisdom of India and the great luxury of Chinese civilization. Between these, as in a valley between two great ranges of mountains, he was in a middle distance between extremes. And in this middle distance, he remained wonderfully himself and became capable of the quiet cultivation of his own nature. Perhaps some part of it was influenced by his convictions or his determinations. Perhaps if he had let go entirely, he might have fallen into one of the psychotic problems that we now know. But this he did not do, apparently. For convinced always of the religious equation, he only demanded or permitted beauty to be fashioned in his vision. When he contemplated, and we know from the poets, that while he was aware of the troubles of his times, in his contemplations he passed over these troubles lightly. His real purpose always was to find a great beauty, a great security, a great exhilaration of spirit. He did not look inside of himself to become a critic, nor did he actually look inside of himself to become a scholar. Mysticism was not to produce formal scholarship, nor great technical advancements in sciences. Mysticism was to produce the motivations by which perhaps other men with other faculties could apply skill to insight and vision. So actually, in this mystical thinking, we have these poets, these dreamers, actually giving us the skeletal structure of an enduring civilization. Actually, civilizations are created by poets and buried by philosophers. So each in his own way is essential. Poetry to give beauty and wings to youth. Philosophy to give patience to age. These are the ways of life, and they were the ways of the desert people. They had their old scholars and their wise men and the priests that could interpret the sacred writings and the teachers of their young, but they also had the great free world of inner movement, of inner symbolism, of inner beauty within themselves. The final development of this concept, as far as generalities are concerned, seems to have been the final achievement of union. This is again our concept of yoga, for the word means union. But these mystics sought to be one forever with the beloved. They wished to give all of themselves, to hold nothing back, to cease to exist in the beloved. We know they are talking of Vedanta. We know they are talking of mysteries. even while perhaps in our own rather superficial way we would like to think that they are speaking merely of sensory gratifications. Actually, to be lost forever in the Beloved was the great goal of Dante and Petrarch and the other great troubadours of Europe. It was to give one's life utterly but a code of chivalry. And out of this came the orders of knight-errantry in Europe, where the great proof of chivalry was the willingness to die utterly for the preservation of honor, beauty, and virtue. So in the individual, this code of chivalry, the Oriental or Japanese code of Bushido, became the code of the mystic, became the code of the dervish and the Sufi. He wished to die for truth, or perhaps more correctly, to die into truth. He knew, as the yoga teaches, that as long as the self remains, truth cannot be perfect. As long as man remains man, he cannot know God in the fullness of his knowing. For in the final union of all these separated and dissonant parts, nothing remains except God. Man vanishes, creation vanishes. Only the eternal love wisdom of deity remains. So this was to die for the Beloved, to cease completely in this strange sense which suggests the Eastern Nirvana. There has been a great deal of talk, a great deal of thought as to the meaning of Nirvana in Buddhism. Whether it meant merely the dying out of the fires of lust and selfishness and greed, or whether Nirvana represented truly and utterly the complete and utter end of self. And the Buddhists themselves divided their thinking into two groups on this. One, that Nirvana was indeed the individual ceasing completely as a living sacrifice to truth. For as long as man existed, error existed. As long as the individual was himself, evil must continue in the world. For man cannot be completely good. And if he appears to be becoming better, it is not because he is increasing in virtue, but because eternal and inevitable virtue itself is increasing in him. The other school of thought is that there is a kind of way in which man can give up being bad by becoming wholly good in himself, that there is this other possible way. And the only way that he can become wholly good, or as nearly completely good as possible, is that he shall become absolutely selfless. That he shall live only for the glory of truth. That he shall exist in this world only to teach, to save, to preserve, to enlighten. This was the holy destinies of the Bodhisattvas, that they should come into embodiment for one purpose only, the salvation of man. Self was dead in them. All human purpose was dead in them. They walked in the bodies of men, but they lived in the Spirit of God. These totally redeemed ones, who appeared to be men, but were really truth walking the earth, these were also the mysterious green vested saints of Islam. These were the arhats. These were the purified ones who could perform miracles by a natural course of things, for their own existence was a miracle. They were the ones who had all the available energies of nature at their disposal, yet they used no energy but truth. Taught no doctrine but law, practiced no miracle but love. And by this strange token, by this wonderful mysticism, they created the concept of a positive identity with deity. That these were no longer persons, but that they had provided channels so that in the perfected ones, truth was made flesh and dwelt among us. That these perfected ones were no longer real persons. They were God. And those who looked into the faces of these perfected ones saw not the faces of men, but the face of God. And whoever had seen this, the one who was a son of God, had seen the Father. For the Father was in the Son, and the Son was in the Father. They dwelt together in a strange, dynamic relationship. This was part of the Eastern tradition that I think finally moved towards Islam. For among the Muslims, we do not find the strange passivity of Southern Buddhism with its doctrine of extinction. We find, rather, the experience of God being a release into an eternal sufficiency. That these saints in their green robes disappeared from among men like the higher orders of the dervishes. They were seen no more by mortals, but those who saw visions in the deserts could see them. And sometimes they would appear in the oasis, far from any other mortal being, to comfort a tired traveler or bring aid to those sick and dying. Then they would fade away again, disappearing into their realm of stars. The Muslim believed in these saints and believed in them completely. And he believed that actually they were persons who had gradually come to change the polarity of their lives, so that the real abode in which they dwelt was the magic garden they had fashioned with their hearts. Having completed this garden, they moved into it. They closed the door behind them, like the Zen monk who walked into his painting and disappeared. They had fashioned a magnificent internal life and retired into that internal life, according to legend, taking even the body with them. In any event, they disappeared. They disappeared into a world of creative thought, a world of universal beauty, a world of transcendent light. And here in their magic gardens, they kept the ancient records, they wrote the poems, they inspired mortals. They lived in a paradise between heaven and earth, a paradise like Amitabha's wondrous world. And in the Sufi and Dervish mysticism, there were these regions also. And the first step was into the temple, into the university in this world, where, studying with the bearded sages and scholars, the young disciple perfected his knowledge of those arts and mysteries which belong to the world of spirit. And so finally it happened that the disciple became one with his teacher. After he had attained this, he entered into the state of meditation and transferred his alliance and allegiance from an earthly teacher to the Prophet Muhammad himself. And here he meditated, dreamed, listened, and sat reverently at the feet of the image which he himself had fashioned. Sensing the presence of Muhammad in the very air about him, he finally became one with his Prophet. And when he had united himself with the Prophet, then he chose the Father goal. He experienced the mystery within himself of standing in the presence of Allah, the great veiled presence of the eternal God. And here he also meditated and prayed, and he listened to the eternal instruction of the eternal Father, until at last he became one with God. These were his three steps. These were the mysterious regions through which he passed. From earth he moved to paradise, and from paradise to eternity. These were his dreams, these were his goals. Perhaps he was a very wise man, perhaps a very confused one, we do not know. But one thing we do realize is that out of the strange legendary and lore of these peoples have come some of the most beautiful thoughts we have ever had in this world. Thoughts of such exquisite refinement, the thoughts so elevating in spirit, that they are like the mysterious galandarios of music, like the strange grace notes of Bach. They make a tired world seem strangely rich and warm with their beauty. And just as the wonderful arabesques upon their mosques, the intricate designs of inlaid semi-precious stones in white marble, are among the treasures of the world, so this strange, subtle pageantry and artistry of their creative insight, painted pictures in words, painted pictures and thoughts, made magnificent panoramas and spectacles, which no other nation ever apparently dared to fashion in the same way. They had the abandon of a great artist. They had the complete freedom of an emancipated soul, using his brush and palette for the revelation of his deepest convictions. And that which he finished in this strange artistry was truly mystical, truly sacred in its substance. And we recognize it today. We recognize something of his purpose underneath all of the appearances of things, simply because good from good comes. And all the beauty of the Near Eastern wisdom can only tell of the strange, deep beauty of the mystics themselves. The mystics were the true priests of Islam. The mystics are the ones who really sensed what happened to Muhammad in the dark nights on Mount Hira. They realized the strange torture of the Prophet's soul. They realized the agony he went through in his own inner seeking for the lost faith of his fathers. The mystics found his soul, and upon the inner teaching of his own great sadness of spirit, the mysterious experience, the mystical experience of the Prophet, when he stood beside the body of his infant son Ibrahim, knowing the child was dead, and fought with himself for faith in Allah against the bereavements of a heartbroken father. And how this struggle led finally to greater and greater dedication. How little by little this man found his union with his God. And the Muslim mystic, instead of copying his teaching from the characters of the Quran, instead of tracing with his fingers the words of the Prophet, sought to know in his heart the agonies of a father, sought to know with his spirit the wonders taking place in the heart of a man who did not believe that he was God, who did not believe that any strange, mysterious power actually dominated his life, who had to make the decisions of a human being, who had to fight each day to keep his own faith. And having won this great battle with himself, finally came victoriously to the first great achievement of the Hijra, and finally to the pilgrimage of Mecca, where standing in the midst of his people, the Prophet revealed the faith of Islam. Here the mystic sees not the splendor of the law. The mystic sees the greatness of a soul weeping over the body of his dead. This is the difference, and out of this difference came the strange, quiet wisdom of the desert, and also this great search for the supreme love of the supreme understanding that makes it possible for man to know with everything that he has in his soul that Allah is great, that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. This was the wisdom of the desert, but in the hearts of men, not in the books of the law. Well, next week we will continue this discussion of the Persian mystics. Thank you very much.